ever so much for coming. What I'm going to do is talk for no more than 15 minutes, maybe just 10 minutes, and then please just start asking questions, and I'll try to answer them very briefly, because the big mistake I always make is then to ramble on and on in answers to questions. And it's trying to learn from each other that we really need to do, because current times are really interesting. Things have changed in the world and in this country, particularly in the last 5 years, in a way that was largely unpredicted by almost anybody. So all those academics saying they knew what was happening and it was terrible and these crises were going to occur, well, nobody actually predicted it that well or that precisely, although lots of people are willing to claim they did. Nobody who claims they predicted it really well will tell you what's going to happen in the next 5 years. I mean, that's the acid test of whether somebody really knows what they're talking about if they claim they could predict this. So we're all remarkably equal when it comes to knowing what's going on and what's possible. What I promised to talk about was inequalities in the UK. So I just talk about the UK as education, work, housing, health and hope. Because the UK is fairly extreme, certainly extreme within Europe. So let's just take education. It's well known that we have a very segregated education system. It's about 7% going to private schools. But as we become more divided, they start being called independent schools rather than private schools. But they are private, you can't just walk into one and say, teach me. What's unusual about our private schools is the number. Most of Europe has very few. And the amount spent in them, which is very high, which is a quarter of all our secondary education spending, roughly. But below those, and I should say within private schools, there are massive inequalities. So parents in the bottom third know they're being completely ripped off for what they're getting. But below private schools, you have a hierarchy just as uneven, just as expensive to do with buying your way into catchment areas and so on. The bulk of Europe has all kinds of issues, but nothing quite like this. Children are not as divided from an early age as they are in Britain. And you end up with this remarkable thing in this country of people talking about having had a good education, having been privileged to have had a good education. And a relative of mine had this, wealthy relative of mine, was quite young and said he was doing really good at maths. He got 98% in maths. And I said to him, what's 98%? He's got no idea. But I got 98% in maths, so I must be good at maths. We end up giving out a huge number of A's and A stars, so we end up telling people that they're very, very able. And then we have a university system, which is more unequal than your average European university system. So you have more scattering across the country of people, you have a steeper hierarchy. The idea of going to your local university, it's normal in Scotland and slightly normal in Wales, but in England it's not that normal because of the hierarchy. And this kind of thing made sense when the country was running an empire and you were having to train people to run an empire and you needed to take them away from home, dehumanise them a bit, and then send them out to rule the planet. And that's where my subject of geography, if you like, came from. We had a crisis of confidence when the colonies went and we had to reinvent ourselves. But today it's a very, very odd thing to do. But it allows you to do things such as be the first country in Europe to bring in US-style fees. It would be hard to see how that could have been done without this kind of hierarchical idea of some universities are worth so much more than others, so we'll have a market in universities. If we had a normal European system, that every big city has one and you tend to go to your local one, it would have been harder to do. And we had a consensus over the fees. So the commission that brought in £9,000 was started by Lord Mandelson under Brown and then finished off by the coalition government. It's just a very, very odd education system to be in that is the pendulum inequality, and is going to drive ever higher inequality as it goes upwards. Very briefly on work, it's easy to get unemployment down. All you do to get unemployment down is you make unemployment benefit worse. So the US in the rich world has one of the lowest rates of unemployment. Our rate is coming down, and we're increasing sanctions, and the amount of money, the benefit you get, is one of the lowest in Europe. We have a huge number of precarious job, part-time jobs, lowly paid jobs. And I argue that the main reason we have these is because we've never paid the top 10%, and in particular the top 1% more. I did a little calculation in the no-nonsense books for the New Internationalist to work out how much money you'd save if you took our top 10% of earners in the country and put them back to 1970s differentials. So still paid more than everybody else, but the same differentials in the 1970s. And the money you'd save, I worked out, would be enough to employ, then there were 1 million people under 25 unemployed. You could employ them all full time on £7 something an hour, 10 times over, just on the saving. And you can make the saving because the main thing that people on high salaries, like me, are doing with their money is buying housing. And they have these salaries because other people on high salaries are getting those high salaries, and they're also buying housing. So if you don't offer the high salaries, you're not going to get the people because the cost of housing is so high, because the incomes at the top are so high. So it's entirely affordable to pay people at the top less. It's just your housing market will come down if you do that. Third one, housing. I think I'm almost on time to go through these. Housing, and again, this is extreme. We're at extreme positions. We have an extreme education system. In work, we're extreme because the precarity is so high in this country, and I didn't talk about the top. We have 2,000 plus bankers paid over €1 million a year, about 2,200. Next highest country is in Germany, with less than 200 bankers paid that much. We are the odd one out. Housing, we're the odd one out. There is no large city in the world where the cost of housing is as high as London now. The last one was Tokyo. Tokyo had the biggest housing crash we've ever seen, but it's such a long time ago that everybody's forgotten about it. It's around about 1990. We have the highest rents, the highest prices. It's really expensive to buy a house. Even though interest rates are very low, you have to borrow a fortune to buy one. The rents are crippling. And it's entirely supported by sentiment. The entire housing market depends on the people thinking it's worth this much. We've had a government since 2010 that have only had one economic policy. And by an economic policy, I mean something you put money behind. So the way to test if it's really a policy is do they spend money on it. And their economic policy has been hold house prices up, if not increase them. And they've managed it. But they've had to keep on introducing more and more things to do it. So the very latest two things was to take away the stamp duty. I'm looking at the ages of you, and you're just far too young, and you have absolutely no chance of ever getting on the housing market for the majority of you to ever worry about the stamp duty limits. But anyway, they took them away, which is going to boost the market. So some landlords will try even harder. And you really are too young. Everybody in the room is too young for this one. If you're taking out your pension right now, you can just grab all the money and buy a buy-to-let flat in London. And they've just, that's the latest in a string of policies. To get our housing to be the most expensive the planet's ever seen just in time for the election. This is very, very odd. I know this isn't social theory and it isn't about, you know, Peter Saunders looking at capital accumulation and other things, but it is just so out of kilter with what was happening before. And I think because we don't know what's going to happen, I think we can't fit it into theory. Two more, health and hope. Health, the extremes for health recently is poor mental health. The most dramatic figures are the prescriptions for antidepressants, mainly Prozac, of which the most details is in Scotland. Scotland has accelerated since 2010. In 2010, it hit an all-time high. But now it's about one in six people in Glasgow taking antidepressants every day. And across the whole of Scotland, it's over one in 10. It's actually accelerating amongst young people, teenagers, particularly aged about 15, particularly girls, if you really want to focus and worry about it. We're getting increased diagnosis of anxiety and depression. Girls are worse than boys. So if you've got children and you want to worry, for years I wanted to produce a paper that actually resubmitted and was turned down by a journal that said if you're going to worry, what you need to worry about is just a small number of things. And don't worry about trees. Kids can climb up trees, they don't die falling out of them, things like that. But I'm not onto hope yet. but if you're going to worry much more about your girls than your boys for poor mental health. Worry about them primarily about age 15, and worry about anxiety and depression. And the real problem is that there are really good reasons to be anxious and depressed now, rational reasons to be anxious and depressed. If you can think back to 2010, there's a report produced by Lord Layard, and there was supposed to be 4,000 behavioural therapists being employed to give us well-being and thinking therapies. Most of that didn't happen, and it mostly didn't happen because the very first cuts that occurred were cuts of things that hadn't been started but were proposed. And it also didn't happen because it's very hard to institute talking therapies about feeling better about stuff when the world economy is falling apart and nobody knows what's going on. And more minor than mental health, but still significant, and it's in the Health Service Journal today, and it might be in Independent tomorrow, we're seeing falling life expectancy for elderly women. So rising deaths amongst women, middle-aged over 85, but not living as long as women were aged over 85 a few years ago. And it's very hard to think that this isn't related to cuts. The big difference between women and men over aged 85 is that a man aged over 85 tends to have a woman with him. A woman aged over 85 tends to be on her own. So when they take away the majority of home visits and when they take away Meals on Wheels, and the official response of the Department of Health, which came out today to the news that the life expectancy of elderly women was falling, was we expect there to be more women aged over 85 next year and in future years. This is the equivalent of being told that the infant mortality rate has risen, which it never does. You know, the rate of babies dying has risen. And for the Department of Health to respond, there have been more births this year and we expect there to be more births in future. It shows, it has to show, it either shows a remarkable degree of callousness or an incredible degree of stupidity. I don't know, we can go first. I've been trying to work out with a journalist today what it means. Does the Department of Health not realise that this is fatuous? Or does it think that the population of Britain is so innumerate that they cannot cope with the idea that, yes, the number of elderly are rising, but the number of dead elderly is rising even faster than the number because the rates are going up and the life expectancy is going down? And I honestly can't work it out. I've got a horrible feeling that what's really happened is that government departments really do now employ press officers who cannot actually cope with these things and hope that journalists can't either and they can get away with it. Hope. Good point to get a hope and to turn around. None of this is sustainable. It's really hard to work out how you make it sustainable. A highly segregated education system is incredibly expensive, which is why we have one. Why does Britain have the great public schools? Why did it have a bigger private sector than anywhere else in Europe? Why did it have the grammar schools built with those kind of lovely columns in front of them? Because we had an empire. Because we were so rich we could afford to have a segregated education system. It's costly. Having a few schools which have 10 or 12 children in the class is very expensive. We had it for historical reasons. Maintaining educational segregation requires a lot of money. it's hard to do. Having children being driven past other children on the way to school rather than walking to the nearest school costs lots of money. So one reason we should expect the current divisions not to exist as they are is simply the expense. But they're buoyed up by fear. Fear is incredibly powerful. And it works in London. So we're sitting in London. London now has the best state schools in the country. The biggest improvement in state education in the country, the safest schools with some of the most innovative teachers, the most fun students to teach, mainly because they come from all around the world. The bottom tenth of London secondary schools do better than the whole of Norfolk and Suffolk. And still the middle class of London are absolutely scared of sending their children to these schools. Whereas not a single London brother gets lower GCSE results than the city I come from, which is Oxford State Schools. And middle class academics still send their kids to Oxford State Schools. So fear can keep it going, but it really is just a matter of time and squeezing, at which point that doesn't become possible. Work, if you think about those top bankers' pay and so on, we actually have finally given in to Europe the limit on the bonus being at least one time salary and not higher is coming through. We are seeing some curtailing at the top. If you look for them, there are loads of signs of optimism. If you compare us now with 5 years ago, there is no new Bob Diamond. There are not people, you know, we've got glasses of wine in plastic cups here. But 6, 7, 8 years ago, people were buying bottles of champagne for £30,000 in clubs not far away from here, with journalists taking photographs of them. Now, all that's ended. It's beginning to end. Housing is the one I feel most optimistic about, if it's well managed, because the best thing that can happen to the people of Britain is that their housing costs fall. It's the equivalent of everybody getting a pay rise and an increase in their benefits if rent and house prices fall. It's the easiest thing to actually achieve. What's hard is trying to achieve it in a slightly measured way rather than a plummeting when the IMF say we're 30% overvalued. We have huge numbers of empty houses. They're all in the private sector. There are entire estates in London now with almost no children, where you see signs saying no ball games, there's no child with a ball, because the flats have been sold under right to buy, and there are single professionals or couples living in them. There's enormous scope to house ourselves better even in London. But London needs to build. But again, that's optimistic. The only reason London needs to build is because London's still attracting immigration. And immigration's amazingly good news. Always has been. When things go badly wrong in a place, people stop coming. Health. Anything you can do that shows particularly young people that you're not being as stupid as you had been being in the last few years should reduce depression and anxiety, if we're being logical about it. So anything that shows, and let's just take Europe as a whole rather than just UK, that Europeans who've never had fewer children, since the 70s we've never given birth to less children. Europe's got a fertility crisis. Never sent more children to university, never educated them more, and never before had 25 million out of work. I mean, it's the most amazing situation to get in. Anything that showed a commitment not to allow this situation to carry on is an improvement on where we currently are. And it's hard to see it getting that much worse. And if you want to be more positive, the response of young people in Europe is not as bad as it was in the 80s. So we have not had a rise in suicides amongst young, which we had in the 80s. We have not had a rise in overdosing on drugs. But sort of the last thing to say before I open it up, and I've gone over slightly over, I'm sorry for doing that. The last thing to say is, what's happening, so much that is currently happening, is not in the interest of such a high proportion of people. Not just almost all of the 99%, but the majority of the thinking 1% are not particularly happy, and it doesn't appear to be helping them. And my argument about the UK, and this is different about the rich world in general, The UK is so extreme, so unequal, has such a mess. It has a bigger income inequality than Israel, and that's including the Palestinians in Israel. You know, it is doing so badly that even if you didn't do anything at all, but just let things carry on playing as they were and didn't try and hold up the inequality, it's likely to regress towards the mean. You could then claim a great success as a government in the next 5 years, just by, if you were not doing policies to try to make the inequality higher. I'll give you one example of that, and I really will stop, so please think of a question. In 1979, there was a book called The Black Report, if you may remember it, in health, about inequalities in health, and the government hated it, and they rushed it out on a bank holiday, but it got lots of press. And it was all about how everything was going to get worse. And lots of things did get worse in the 80s. But there was one part of it, and it was done by Peter Townsend, where he identified the 10 areas of the country with the worst health and said, if something isn't done, these are going to get worse or stay as bad. Five of those areas actually improved dramatically without anything being done, because they were the very worst areas. And in fact, it was immigration. It was parts of London, very poor parts of London in 79-80, where people arrived from the Caribbean into Brixton who were healthy, and the health improved. And that's partly what I mean by you should expect things to get better, because when you're this extreme, it is hard for them to get worse. The other example would be the United States right now, where the United States, the top 1%, are now taking something like 22% of all income. It's back to early 1920s levels. It's an absolute outlier worldwide. It may well, it looks like a high point. But it all looks very, very dark. You don't sort of see it as that. But the Obama regime finally, and it's taken so long to do it, nobody's noticed, have finally increased the tax take in the States, and particularly increased income tax on people earning more in the States. But it took them so long to do it that nobody's celebrating the fact that they've done it. But things do get better. They have to get better. They can't always get worse. But we don't notice when they do or possibly do begin to get better. It's not a bad thing, because if you do notice it and sit back, they won't get much better. You've got to get angry. But you've got to realise they can. Going until somebody sticks a hand up, I'm going to start. Very last thing. We were our most unequal just after the First World War. That's the most unequal Britain had ever got. We became progressively more equal in everything, education, health and so on, in the 20s and the 30s. Half of it was achieved before the Second World War, and nobody noticed, because other terrible things were happening in the 20s and 30s. And that might be what the next 5 or 10 or 15 years is going to be like. It's going to feel really bad, it's going to be pretty awful, people are going to be very pissed off, it could be highly confrontational, hopefully not deadly, which is what happened last time. But as that is happening, it's possible that we will begin to see these divides falling. The problem is, you can't say, that's great, it's getting slightly better, because we've got such a long way to go just to become normal. The kind of inequalities that it's normal to have for a European country, for an OECD country, and we're a long way away for that, and I think that's where I think the target for a loser country like the UK should be. If a child's at the bottom of a class, you don't try and get the child to the top of the class, you try and get the child to the middle class. And that's where we are on social policy and inequality. Thank you very much.